From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Oral History Catch-Up. I'm sat here on a very blustery day at Bletchley Park, upstairs in the mansion, and we thought to start off the 2023 season of podcasts, we'd sit down, as we did last year, with our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, and have a bit of a catch-up with Jonathan on how everything, Roll of Honour and oral history, is going. Happy New Year, Jonathan.
And you, Mark. Thanks. Good to be back.
Now, this time last year, we were sat, I think, down in Block A, weren't we? Well, I think we were upstairs, weren't we?
That's right. I remember it well, yes.
It's been a big year for Bletchley, obviously. The Intelligence Factory opened. Great for your role, because so much of that has come from what you've been doing for the last 10, 11 years, 12 years.
That's right. It was very gratifying, I think is the right word, to see so much of the work that my volunteers and I have done reflected in the exhibition, where the visitor can actually listen to the voices of the veterans talking about their work and life at Bletchley Park and elsewhere.
And it's that contact that you and the volunteers have with the veterans that then brings in those other items, isn't it? You know, documents, and the number of times I've listened to interviews where, you know, they'll say, oh, I've got this.
That's right, yes. Veterans have been very generous at, in some cases, donating or maybe loaning, allowing us to copy photographs and documents. So we're still very much interested in those personal things. Please don't send them in, because we do have to go through a process to make sure they're properly accepted and accounted for. But if anyone out there does have photographs of themselves or indeed their family, their relatives connected with Bletchley Park during the war, then we'd be very interested in hearing from you.
Or any broken code messages they never gave back.
Yeah, as you probably know, people have found things in the attic that should not have been kept.
No.
But 80 years later, it's great that they were and helped cast a great deal of light on how code breaking was done. There are documents people have kept that did that.
It's those interviews that you and the team have been carrying out that have really helped to build the Intelligence Factory, haven't they? I mean, the Naval Plotting Room, so much of that came... I'm forgetting the lady's name, but you went out and did some follow-up interviews.
Yes, the lady who sadly passed away a few months ago, Sheila Wilson.
Yes, Sheila Wilson.
Who I interviewed about 5 or 6 years ago. And, of course, it was the general interview where we ask everything about their wartime life. They talk about their recruitment to work for Bletchley Park, their training and their work. And she was talking about what was called the British plot, the plot of where British and Allied ships were at any moment. And when we came to start planning the Intelligence Factory exhibition, the plot is a major part of it. And Sheila very kindly allowed me to come back and talk to her again in more detail.
And I think the episode I did with Thomas and David, we spoke about, and we used some of that audio of you actually explaining to Sheila why you were coming back for these extra interviews.
Yes.
Yeah. It's having a resource like that that's really kind of taken Bletchley Park's exhibitions to a whole new level, really, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because we have these first-hand accounts that probably a lot of museums wouldn't be able to have.
No, I think we've been lucky. We've been doing it, you know, I have to say this is probably just in time that we're getting those first-hand accounts of people who played the key roles. They were maybe the unsung heroes, but they were part of that figure we hear so often, the nearly 9,000 people who worked at Bletchley Park, plus the at least as many again who worked at the outstations and in the Y service and all the other bits that made up the signals intelligence network at the time.
And it's everyone. It's, you know, for example, Sheila's a great example. Sheila just worked on a watch, which is quite a lowly task.
Yes.
Compared to, you know, she wasn't a Turing or a Welshman or a Tiltman. She was just a probably 18, 19-year-old girl, as she would have called herself then, working a three-shift system. But because of her and because of her memory and because of you and your team saving that, we can now show everyone who comes to visit Bletchley Park what that really looked like. And that's so important. Yeah. That must make you really proud.
It does. And I have to say, yes. And also, not only are we getting Sheila's story and correctly honouring what she did, but we can tell people whose relatives did similar jobs, who perhaps never spoke about it, that, well, we don't have your grandmother's story, but we interviewed someone who did something very similar. So if you look at this, for example, on the Roll of Honour, the oral history write-up, or when audio is made available through things like this, you can actually find out almost by proxy what your relative did during the war, get a feel, and not only what they did, but the life they led, you know, the training they did, you know, the social sort of situation they were in.
So talking about Roll of Honor, this time last year, it had finally gone back online after a bit of a hiccup. Have we had some changes on that? Is it all fully working now?
Yes, it is now. At the time, a year ago, it was there. It was certainly readable. There were a few problems that were still being ironed out. One was it couldn't be updated. So it was frozen as it was in November 2021, which meant that people were telling us about themselves, about their relatives, either people we'd not heard of before at all or additional information to add to a record or providing photographs. So we couldn't update it. And also a key feature that I just briefly mentioned earlier, the oral history write-ups, which appear as attachments that were not there. They were just missing. There were technical issues, which have now, I'm very glad to say, been fixed. So for the last few months now, I've been able to update it and we show the attachments, including oral history write-ups that are on it. I should point out that I know a lot of people were in touch and I was going back and saying, well, I will update your relative's record or your record as soon as we can, but we have a problem at the moment. And the problem is fixed. And I must say, I haven't actually updated every single record because it's quite a backlog, but we are going through them as quickly as we can. That's to say me and the volunteers who assist me. So hopefully in the next few weeks, all the things that I said would be changed will be changed. So I say there's still a bit of a backlog. So, you know, please, if I haven't done the promised update yet, I haven't forgotten. It's on my list of things to do.
Now, oral history. Obviously, pandemic and post-pandemic, people are still possibly a little bit worried. And just the passage of time as well. Have we managed to do any extra oral history interviews?
It has to be said that compared with 3 years ago, the numbers we're doing are greatly reduced for inevitably as the passage of time. Certainly, a couple of years ago, there was a great deal of caution, not least amongst ourselves, about going to other people's homes and interviewing them. Although, you know, we are still doing them occasionally. In fact, we did one earlier this week, a few days ago. You know, if there are veterans out there who have a story to tell or their families are aware of them, you know, please, please, you know, we are still very interested in hearing that story. We'll come to you, a date to suit you and your family, and record the story. So please don't think we're no longer recording oral history, because we very much are, yes.
Yeah, any opportunity, we're more than happy, and we will work around the families and the veterans, won't we? Well, we can only hope that we can still, you know, just get those last few that maybe we haven't had.
And perhaps just a reminder that perhaps very praiseworthy that for so long the veterans didn't talk about it, but just remember they are allowed to. GCHQ have made it quite clear that they're allowed to talk about their wartime service at Bletchley Park and related places. So if anyone out there is thinking, well, shall I tell the story? Please do. And don't think for one moment that you weren't important enough, because all your stories are interesting. We want to hear everyone who worked at Bletchley Park in the Y service, all the places I could list in the usual long list of places we're interested in.
Like we just said, you know, we just spoke about Sheila. That's a prime example. You know, she wasn't a highfalutin important person. She worked on a shift with another bunch of girls working in the passing room.
But it was important and, you know, demanding work. So, yeah, but yes, you're right. She wasn't one of the famous names of Bletchley Park. Well, perhaps she is now.
Yeah.
In a way, yes.
Now, for the rest of this episode, as we always do with these oral history shows, we're going to take three excerpts from our oral history collection. Now, in the past, we've had themes, haven't we, Jonathan?
Yeah.
Or we've talked about, we had somewhere we were collecting people who worked outside Bletchley Park, who lived here. But we've gone completely random this time, haven't we?
Yes, we have, yeah.
So who have we got first?
Well, the first one we've got was someone who isn't, strictly speaking, a veteran of Bletchley Park, in that she did not work in signals intelligence during the Second World War, but she did work at Bletchley Park. Her name is Jean Barrett.
So if she didn't work in signals, so how did she work at Bletchley Park?
Right. A slight exaggeration. She visited Bletchley Park as part of her job. She left school, I think, at 14 and got a job with the Co-op Bakery in Bletchley, which was a major industry in those days. And as some of us may remember, bread used to get delivered a lot by the local bakers to one's home. And as well as all delivering to many of the citizens of Bletchley, they had a big order from Bletchley Park. So several times a week, she would come in the van, not driving, but assisting the driver, in through the gates of Bletchley Park and deliver bread to be eaten by the staff here.
So she's going to tell us all about her top secret loaves.
That's right, yes. And of course, she didn't have a clue what was going on here. And you know, it's always one of the things we always like to people to stress when we interview them, people who, if you like, are on the outside. And she was coming right into the heart of this secret operation as an innocent 14-year-old girl and delivering what any code breaker needs, food, bread.
Split tins.
Yeah. Yes. The reason we got to know about Jean and she readily agreed to be interviewed about this was a few years ago, she got in touch with us because she had something previously belonging to Bletchley Park, the government go to cipher school, to donate to us.
So what was this?
Well, it wasn't something like an Enigma machine or part of Colossus, as one would be very exciting. So something a little bit more mundane, but still vital, actually, in any work situation. She had two chairs.
How did she come about these, then?
She acquired these chairs because in 1946, or maybe shortly after, when Government Code and Cipher School moved Lock, Stock and Barrel out of Bletchley Park to what had been one of its outstations at Eastcote in northwest London, they had a big closing down sale. So there was chairs and desks and all sorts of things.
Really?
Yeah, because of even though they were moving to new premises, they were no longer than 9,000 people. They'd reduced,
of course, yeah.
Reduced greatly in size, although...
They probably took all the best ones.
Took the best ones. Yeah. And so they're very, very plain chairs. They don't have arms. They certainly don't swivel or anything like that. They're probably ones you might have perhaps in a dining room or something like that. And very good condition. So she donated them to us. A few weeks after the interview, she came in with her son to hand them over to us. And they're safely nestled at the moment in our new store.
And I'm with Mrs. Jean Barrett, née Bandy, who, as a teenager, has some memories of Bletchley Park, and very interested to hear about those. So, start at the beginning. What's your first memories of Bletchley?
My first memories must be before the war. Hmm. I can't remember the date that it would be, but it was when Bletchley Park, when Lord and Lady Leon used to hold a bank holiday, I don't know what you would call it, a fete, a fair, whatever. It was a very big concern. They had lots going on. They had animals there, a lot of horticultural things, because my granddad used to show vegetables and flowers there. So it was quite a big, it was a whole day out, and families used to go, the whole families used to go and enjoy the time in Bletchley Park. So I think, yes, they would be my very first memories of Bletchley Park. And that went on for quite a long time, these shows. Look forward to them. My grandfather was rather interested in being there because some years before then he used to play cricket with Lord Leon. So that was his memory of Bletchley Park. And, of course, it carried on because of that we went there. And, of course, war broke out when I was 11 years old. So it had been going on. I left school at 14. So it had been going on 3 years before I started to go to work in Bletchley because that was the nearest town to get any work.
Where were you living at the time? Roughly?
I was living in a little village called Newton Longville, which is about 2.5-3 miles from Bletchley, yes. And we had to go to Bletchley, as I say, to get work. And I started work in the bakery in Park Street.
Can you remember much what Bletchley Park looked like when you were very young going to these? And obviously, it must look very different apart from the mansion.
Oh, it's much different now. Yeah. Much different. We used to go in from the main road. There were some big gates, which I've got a photo of. There were big wrought iron gates. And we used to go in through these gates, and I can remember a lodge house on the left-hand side, and just round the corner from there was the pavilion. And there was a road going off to the left, a road going off to the right. Well, they weren't roads. They were just a walkway, I suppose. When we went to the shows, we didn't go to the left. We went to the right, and it was a big, huge, open ground, as much as I can remember of it. It was vast. To me, it was vast anyway. It must have been very big because they had 3 or 4 huge marquees in there.
You went to school in Newton Longville. Was it a local school?
We had a little local school there, yes, that you went to until you were 11 years old. And then at 11 years old, we used to have to bus then every day to Bletchley, to the Bletchley Road Senior School, Leon School, I think it's called.
Right, I know Leon School, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. So let's go back to starting work at the bakery when you were 14.
Right, yes, had to cycle, of course, everywhere. And so we used to cycle to the bakery to work for 8 o'clock in the morning. And there weren't places that you could buy sandwiches and cups of tea and coffee shops. I mean, there wasn't a couple of coffee shops, but you hadn't got the money to do that. So we cycled home again at lunchtime, had an hour and a quarter for lunch. So you cycled home, cycled back, had your lunch, and then cycled home again at night, you know. And when I started work at the bakery, I was inside the bakery for a while. And then I was transferred to the packing department. And when you were in the packing department, if you were needed on one of the bread rounds or something like that because someone was off ill, you were the one that had to go on that and do that. That I didn't like. I didn't like the bread rounds at all. But you also had to do, if you were needed, what they call the locals. The locals were delivering cakes, bread, flour to the local shops like Fenny, several in Bletchley, Water Eaton, Old Bletchley, or anywhere around in the vicinity we used to deliver, which was some of the villages, you know, we used to deliver to. And, of course, in amongst that, there was Bletchley Park that we delivered to.
What were you on? It wasn't a motor vehicle, was it? A horse-drawn, was it?
Oh, no, a little van.
So a motor van.
Yes, a little motor van that I wasn't driving. A lady called Mrs. Poles, she was driving the van, and she was always the driver on the locals' van. And she needed an assistant sometimes, and that's when, because I was in the department, that's when they called on me. Right. And, of course, one of the places, as I say, that we used to deliver to was Bletchley Park.
Yes. So tell me about what was that like? What did you see?
I can't remember a lot about it. I used to love going there, I know that, because I used to love to go in the park because it reminded me of younger days when I used to go to the shows. So I loved going, but we didn't drive through that main gate. We drove from somewhere else that I can't remember the entrance to it, but I can remember going in there and we went under a tower with a clock over the top.
I know, yeah.
And I know that we used to drive under there, and that's where all the huts were, as far as I can remember. And these huts were like prefab huts. And we didn't deliver to all of them, but we delivered to some of them. And it was just bread and cakes that we used to deliver, you know. There were people about, but who they were, I haven't a clue. They were in uniform.
I guess we're talking about when you started. This was about 1942.
Yeah, 42, yes. 43, yeah. Something like that.
So that's about the time the place was beginning to really expand.
Was it?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes.
So, of course, now, you know, you've got all those big brick buildings there, what we call the blocks.
Yes.
Do you remember there being much building that you would see going on?
I don't remember any building. Going on at all.
Yeah, but then you only saw a bit of it.
I only saw a bit of it. Yeah. And you see, we were probably only allowed in a bit of it anyway. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that then, but I know now that it could have been we were only allowed in these certain places to go to, because they wouldn't have anyone roaming about sort of thing.
Did anybody ever say, either in the bakery or anywhere else, give you any hint that this was a very secret place, or did they just not say anything?
No, we had no idea. Mm. I'm talking about I was 14, 15, whether grown-ups, as I've got to call them now, whether they knew anything more, I don't know. But as for myself and all around my age, we had no idea that something was going on there. Yeah. No, nothing at all. There was only one little clue. It was a clue that I can think of now, but we didn't really take any notice of it then. But every so often, there used to be a lot of red caps about and a lot of police about. Now, I mean, we only had two or three policemen in Bletchley anyway, so where they come from, I don't know. And there used to be more policemen about. Yes. There's always seemed more traffic going on. But that was the only thing we noticed. Whether they were the times when, because I believe Mr. Churchill used to come down and visit.
Or other senior officers, of course.
Or yes, or something. Or yes, that's it. Yeah. Something like that. But that is the only thing that I can say was different.
Yeah, and that was occasionally just.
And that was just occasionally. Yeah. Yes, that was just occasionally.
Yeah. The bakery sounds like quite a big business, though. Was it sort of?
Oh, it was huge. Yeah. It was the only one. They used to supply bread to the whole town and all the villages around, such as Newton Longville, where I came from, Stoke Hammond, Drayton Parslow, Stutely, all those villages were all supplied by the co-op. Yeah. Yes.
By certainly 1943, 1944, Bletchley Park had an enormous great sort of canteen, cafeteria for all the people working there.
That's right, they did.
And they must have made their own bread, I would guess.
No, they didn't. We delivered to them.
We delivered to them.
But that was outside the gate, wasn't it, that canteen?
Yes, so you went there as well.
Yes, that was outside the gate. And I just remember delivering to them as well.
Any idea how much bread? I know it's a silly question, but I mean, if there were 10,000 people working there...
Was there really? Well,
by the end of the war, there were 10,000 people working there because it was on shifts, only a third of them.
By the end of the war, I wasn't on that, on the bakery anyway.
Yeah. Your bakery was quite an important sort of...
Oh, it was an important part of the whole setup for bread because... There weren't places like Tesco's and Sainsbury's and things like that in the town. So it was all co-op shops those days, you see. And, of course, the co-op bakery supplied all the co-op shops with the bread.
Yeah. I suppose you would have been too young to have known about this side of things, but obviously all the sort of... The amount of flour they got must have been very tightly controlled with the rationing and all that sort of stuff, I suppose.
Yes, I suppose it was, but I didn't know anything about that, you know. They made the bread, we delivered it sort of thing, but and we did deliver cakes. How that was rationed out, I haven't got a clue about that.
What sort of cakes were they, tell me?
We used to make all sorts of things, little cupcakes, slices, date slices, I can remember very much, that we used to make. More or less the same type of thing that they make today. I can remember the gattos that we used to make because I can remember wrapping those. And they were a sponge cake with the piece of middle cut out and jam or fruit put in. And then put on top with cream.
Nice.
And I can remember those. The bakery was run at that time by a man called Mr. Maycock, and his secretary was Miss Wells. I enjoyed working at the bakery. Yes, I did. I did. But you see, those days we didn't used to keep a job for very long. We used to flit about, I'm afraid, from one to another. And when I left the bakery, that is when I went to Perrin's tea shop. During the war years, I had three different jobs. So there was the one at the bakery, the one at Aunt Doris's, and then I worked on the MOS, which was the Ministry of Supply.
But the tea shop, what did you make of these people, or nothing at all, you know, the people from Bletchley Park? What were they
We used to get so many in, you see. I mean, there was forces around Bletchley everywhere because there was aerodromes and things like that, airfields. And there was the camp, the RAF camp in Shenley Road at that time, which was a very big camp. And then there was Bletchley Park. And then there was other areas that had soldiers and whatnot in. And we used to get a real mixture of people. We had Egyptians in there, I remember once. Yes, we did. And while we live there, you know, Bletchley Park used to billet people, some of their people out. Well, we had a soldier there, Aunt Doris's, that was billeted with her. Yes, a Sergeant Jenkins. I don't know whether it was Jenkins or Jenkins. It was a Sergeant Jenkins. We used to call him... I can't remember whether we called him Jinx or Jenks, but it was one of those two. And he worked in Bletchley Park, I know, and he was lodging with my Aunt Doris. And he was in the Intelligence Corps, I remember that. And I can remember him strolling through the shop and going into the private part of the house, you know. And he would always say hello and things like that, but I didn't know him well. But I just know that he lodged there,
Bletchley in wartime, I mean, presumably it was like anywhere else, blackouts and air raid war.
Exactly. And no lights showing and things like this, you know, no signpost. And if you rode a bike, as I did, as I said, we used to have, like the cars did, a shield over the lamp But there wasn't all that much traffic about it. Any traffic that there was all army or air force or something. This is during the war.
Were there any German air raids on or near Bletchley that you remember?
Yeah, I remember one in particular. This was while I was still at school. I know that in St Mary's Church there was three bombs dropped there.
Yes.
I think it was three. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember one particular night while I was still at school at the time, and we had these evacuees, which were actual cousins of mine, and three of us went to the cinema in Bletchley. We came home in the evening on the bus. I can't tell you what time it was, but we came home on the bus from Bletchley to Newton. And my aunt, that was my cousin's mother, she met us off the bus because it was dark, you see. So she met us off the bus and we were walking. We'd got about, I would say we'd walked about 100 yards and we were by Newton Longville Churchyard. And my aunt had lived in London, so she knew all these bombs. And she said, "That's a cherry plane." We didn't know how she knew, but she said she knew the sound, you know. And then all of a sudden we heard this whiz noise, and I can remember her getting all of us and pushing us into the bank of the churchyard because it was a bank going up from the road, and she pushed us into the bank, and this whiz come over us, and then we heard an explosion, and it was a bomb that had dropped from this. It was a Jerry plane, and it dropped about, would it have been, about a mile or a mile and a half away from us. I believe the indentation is still there in Stoke Road, where it dropped.
Okay.
Stoke Road, which is,
that.
Yeah, you look for that.
I will.
Yes, please do. But yes, this bomb dropped there. So that was my one and only and nearest encounter with a bomb.
So
but I do remember that, yes, very, very clearly.
Yeah. You said earlier on you moved to a third job after the tea shop, tea rooms.
Yes, I had worked at the bakery, then I worked at Aunt Doris's, which is Perrins.
Yeah.
Then I went to the MOS. I must have, because I was there, yes, a year, or just over a year. And the reason I changed, because the money was quite good on the MOS, you see. And the MOS was in the London Brick Company grounds at Newton Longville.
Right, yeah.
And I was there when war finished. Yes, I was there for about 12 months, I think.
And it's fascinating because, I mean, you know, you've told us a little insight into Bletchley Park and about the bread and everything, but also what happened outside Bletchley Park, and which we don't really hear enough about, because there was, people getting on with their normal lives as best they could in the war, and doing all sorts of extraordinary things.
And it wasn't until after the war, of course, that we knew something went on.
When do you remember hearing about that?
I would imagine that it was a year, 18 months, maybe 2 years after everything was all finished at Bletchley Park. There was nothing going on there at all. Still didn't know anything about the Enigma machine or Colossus or anything like that. Had no idea about that at all. But we knew that all the forces that worked in Bletchley Park had gone, because it was then they got rid of a lot of the furniture. And I think that's when we realised Bletchley Park had finished, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because that's when I acquired the two chairs that I've got and the waste paper basket.
Yes.
So whether they, as I say, came from the actual mansion house or any of the huts, I do not
never know.
No, I don't know.
Somebody will ask us when we have them there, which hut was this in?
Now, second up in this episode, we've got another strange connection or non-connection to Bletchley Park, haven't we, from our oral history connection?
Yes, a very nice lady called Lois Barefield contacted us saying she'd like to be interviewed. Didn't give much detail about what she'd done, but codes were mentioned. So I went off to visit her in the lovely town of Malvern, and it turned out that she wasn't actually a Bletchley Park person at all. She'd slightly sort of misunderstood what it was we were looking for, but to our advantage, I have to say, She actually worked for SOE, the Special Operations Executive. Now, as I'm often stressing to people, that was completely separate from Bletchley Park and Government Code and Cypher School. Code breaking on the one hand and sending secret agents behind enemy lines is something you keep very separate. But what they did have in common with Bletchley Park is that they were dealing with codes. They were dealing with the coded messages back from secret agents. So that's the sort of thing she was dealing with in Baker Street.
Ah, right. Okay. So I'm guessing there's a slight link there, possibly through Mansfield College.
Yes, certainly. Although Lois would not have had an involvement with this herself, certainly at the higher levels, there were links between SOE and Government Code and Cypher School. Because another thing we often forget is Government Code and Cypher School, as well as breaking enemy codes, which is, of course, the story we concentrate on at Bletchley Park, was also responsible for the security of our own messages. So produce code and ciphers for use by British and Allied forces.
And that's an episode that Thomas went into detail about our code making and code breaking last year.
That's right. Now, SOE is probably slightly one step removed even from that because they had their own empire. Their chief code maker was a man called Leo Marx, who wrote a very interesting book about it.
He wrote the post-war history, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, he wrote Silk and Cyanide, and it's a very interesting, very, very entertaining book. And he has links at upper levels with the people at Bletchley Park cooperating on making sure that the codes that our secret agents are using in terrible danger are as safe as possible. So Lois really was, in a sort of rather loose way, part of the whole...
A lucky accident,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
I mean, without her contacting us, we probably wouldn't have her story.
We wouldn't. And I'm not aware that stories like hers are as perhaps as well recorded as we've been lucky with the Bletchley Park stories to do. So it's good that we've got it.
That's quite a coup, actually.
I'm with Miss Lois Barefield, who's going to tell us about her work with SOE in Baker Street. But can we start with can you tell me what you were doing before you started working for SOE?
I was working for an insurance company which had been evacuated from London. It was called the Reliance Insurance Company. And they were evacuated to what would now be called a stately home at Southborough, near Tunbridge Wells. And I had been working there since about 1940, because we used to go out and watch the planes fighting during the Battle of Britain. It was a large mansion which had many acres of ground, including some woodland, and the army had put up Nissen huts in some of the grounds, and we had various regiments stationed there for short times doing their military training. Mm. I remember once we had a Scottish regiment complete with bagpipes, who used to play at parades. Mm. I've never liked bagpipes. And it was a bit disconcerting, as you may well imagine. They told me that I was to do work of national importance. Mm. They couldn't call me up because of the state of my father's health. Mm. So I went for a short time into the nursing profession, but I soon found that that was not my forte at all. I could cope with the written work, but practical, I was hopeless. So the Labour Exchange told me that I still had to do work of national importance, and they had these jobs going at Baker Street, London. So they sent me for an interview. So I went up to Charing Cross on the train from Tunbridge Wells and went to Baker Street. And I was told where the offices were. And when I got there, I can remember that all the entrances were sandbagged. It was in the old Marks and Spencer's building near Portman Square. And I found I had to find my own billet. But first I had to get through a test. They asked me about all sorts of things, whether I was interested in doing crossword puzzles. And I said I was, because my mother and I used to do cryptic crossword puzzles, and I still do them now. Mathematics, not the pure maths, but certainly arithmetic and all the necessaries to do office work. I had Royal Society of Arts certificates in shorthand typing and bookkeeping, and I was interested in figure work. Mm. My father at the time was the chief clerk at the Tunbridge Wells Equitable Friendly Society, and he used to be able to add up columns of pound shillings and pence without writing down a single carry forward figure. And the auditors of that friendly society were always trying to catch him out.
Wow.
But they never did. But Dad was a fine arithmetician, if you like. Mm. So anyway, I was met for, of course, there was an army, I forget whether he was, I can't remember whether he was a captain or a major, but one of the two. And I was faced with an inquiry as to what work I was doing or trained for. Mm. And then I was confronted with a sheet full of traction sums. I think there were five figures. I can't remember now, but I think there were five figures. Anyway, they thanked me very much and sent me off and said they would let me know. Well, a few days later, I got a confirmation that I had the job, whatever it was. And so I went back up to London and found this hostel for business girls at the other end of Baker Street, near the Marylebone Road. And I remember I had to share a room with other girls. I also remember that we had one of the girls whose name was Maggie Wortley, who was a student at the Rock, either the Royal Academy of Music or the Royal College of Music, and she was training to be an opera singer. And I couldn't help thinking that she might wish to change her name should she ever succeed.
Yes.
With a name like Maggie Wortley.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, I had to share a room with another girl. There were about, I think there were about eight of us in that building. Mm. And I didn't get any help with keep. Mm. As it were. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember what salary I had, but anyway. And after about a month, I had to go in for a test as to what I could do. And at that time, my aunt in Tunbridge Wells, my father's brother's wife, was a postwoman. And she openly admitted to my mother that she always read the postcards when she delivered them, because we had a friend staying with us from London, actually, from Wood Green, whose name was Bunny. The nickname was Bunny. And one day my aunt was delivering postcards, and an ordinary post to Mother, and she knocked the door and said, "Did Bunny enjoy her visit?" So my mother said, "Oh, did you know Bunny was coming to stay?" "Oh," she said, "I read the postcard." So when I had to go in for this exam, I said to Mother, "If I don't pass the exam, I'll write you a postcard which says, 'The stars have fallen,' or something like that." "If I do pass," I said, "I will write something to make Aunt Dorothy wish she'd never read it." because my aunt had been told, of course, that I'd gone to London, but she didn't know what for. So I did pass the exams, so I wrote a postcard to Mother. Baby arrived safely, have named her Dorothy. If I aren't ready, she never said anything to Mother, and Mother didn't say anything to her either. So I invented my own secret code.
That's good, yeah. You were in the right job for it.
I thought you might be me.
Yes, very, very good, one. Yes.
Because what she thought when she read that postcard, heaven only knows. I didn't have any signals training or anything like that. It was purely this code work that I was involved in.
So you didn't use any sort of machine to do the coding?
No, no, it was all manual, all manual work. I think there was a teleprinter somewhere which we got, you know, to decode or encode or whatever. But I never used a teleprinter. It was all manual work.
And can you remember what these coded messages looked like before you worked on them? Were they in groups of letters or numbers?
Yeah, groups of figures, five figures, you see. And we had the code book, but I can't remember where they came from or anything like that, you know.
No.
All I know, it was all figures.
Figures.
And subtraction.
So when you'd worked on one of these codes, did it then appear as letters, or was it just four numbers? Can you remember?
I think it was numbers.
Yes.
I think it was numbers all the time. Yeah.
So
it's translated into letters. Yeah.
But you didn't see the letters. Somebody else did that. Is that right? Did you pass it on to somebody else to turn the numbers into letters?
I forget how they were given to us. I forget that. We got it from some other office further down the corridor or upstairs or downstairs. These groups of either letters or figures. Yeah. And we had to use the code book to decipher them.
But once you decipher them, were you able to read them? Did they make? Was it normal?
Yes, but they didn't make any sense.
No.
At least they didn't appear to.
No. But were they worked?
If they were absolutely hopeless, we had to start over again.
Yeah.
Yes. If we were encoding, we had to transfer for letters to figures.
Yeah.
And it was the opposite way around coming in. That's right.
Thank you.
That's right. Yeah.
So when you saw the messages before you encoded them, could you understand them? Were they written in normal English, or were they just groups of letters? Or
I think they were mostly in English.
Yeah.
Or it may have been because that branch of, I found out afterwards that it was the French section.
Yes.
You see, and some of them may have been in, some of the words might have been in French.
Yes.
But as I learned French at school when I was about five.
Wasn't
and all I know is La Plume de ma tante.
Yes.
Or the joke about the Frenchman who had three French kittens and he named them un deux trois.
Oh.
And he had a pond at the bottom of his garden, and in winter the pond froze over. And un, deux, trois went skating until one day the ice broke and un, deux, trois cat sank.
Oh dear. I haven't heard that. That's good.
Have you heard
that? No, I haven't. That's a new one. That's good. I'll remember that.
I think I got it off some show on the radio or something. Anyway, you carry on.
No, just a bit more about these messages. Did they tell you where they were coming from and where they were going to? Did they tell you that at the time?
I just can't remember No. We had to hand them on to another department.
Mm.
So I don't think we ever knew exactly. We might make a guess.
But did you know they were to do with secret agents?
Oh, yes. We were told that.
The reason I ask that is that some of the people at Bletchley Park didn't know that they were breaking enemy codes.
Some
were told, some worked out, had a good idea what they were doing, but didn't talk about it. So you did at least know what you were part of.
That's right. And as I say, we did find out that Colonel Buckmaster was in charge. Mm. I believe I did see him once, but only, didn't talk to people like us.
Yeah.
He went to see the bosses.
Mm. but I understand that Colonel Buckmaster was in charge of the French section of SOE.
Yes, we were told that. And he... I've got the book of Odette, of course, I've read that.
Yes.
And, of course, it says in there that he did a lot of the interviewing for agents and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Somewhere in the Charing Cross Road, wasn't it? Or
probably, yeah.
The back of Charing Cross Station, something like that.
Where you worked, you would never have seen the agents themselves.
No. Well, at least if we did, we didn't know.
Well, that's, I suppose they wouldn't have said, "I'm a secret agent," would they? So, be a bit silly. Yeah. Did you ever find that some of the messages were difficult?
Oh, yes. Yes, it didn't make really sense because, like, words like Pluto, I mean, we found out afterwards it's pipeline under the ocean, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, coming through on a message didn't make sense.
No. Were there sometimes messages that you couldn't decipher because there was something wrong with them when they'd been received or transmitted, perhaps? Was that ever a problem? Do you know?
We just had to do another test, and if they were still indecipherable, well, then we just... pass them on to somebody in a higher direction who might be able to make sense of them.
Yes.
Some of us couldn't.
Yeah. Because that book I was reading on the way here by this man, Leo Marx, he was working on the messages that didn't decipher. So some of them that you couldn't do probably went to him. And he had he was very, very clever, and he managed to work out where the agent had gone wrong in their message.
Well, it might have been interrupted in transmission or something like that, you see. But anyway, we were just pawns. And there were a lot of girls there who had signed up to join the Fannies. Mm. There were people like that who were anticipating being sent overseas because they had a list of things that they had to take with them and all that. And so on and so forth.
Yes.
And they were discussing those in the intervals of, their work. If we were not too busy, somebody would say, "Well, what are we going to do about such and such, female things?"
Yes, of course.
Yes.
So some of the people you worked alongside, they were joining the Fannies, were they?
Apparently, yes.
Wow. Did you ever have any dealings that you know of with any other SOE establishments, particularly some in the countryside?
Well, we knew of Bletchley Park, of course.
Yes.
I mean, it was common knowledge that they were trying to break these German codes. And we knew that some place out at Bletchley...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd never been to Bletchley.
No.
I'd never been to the mansion or anything.
No.
Now, for our final selection, we're going to feature someone who wouldn't have had a clue about this place existing during World War II and probably would have gone as white as a ghost if he had known about it. Because... well, I'll let you tell the story because he's very unique, isn't he?
Yes. His name was Rudy Scherbel. That doesn't sound like a typical Bletchley Park name.
No.
Very good reason. He was on the other side. He was a Luftwaffe code and cipher operator based in Guernsey. Basically, he was the guy that Bletchley Park were up against, or one of them. And being in Guernsey, he became a prisoner of war at the end of the war. And long story, settled in this country and made his rest of his life and had a large and loving family until he sadly died a couple of years ago. But he was very, very keen to tell us his story. And one of our volunteers, Mike, went and did a really good interview with him, which is fascinating. I mean, it's like all these interviews, you're getting both the technical stuff, you know, how did you break codes? Or in this case, how did you protect the codes on the other side? But the human stories, and there's a fantastic story where he actually smuggled food from the German forces' supplies to a local family. And I mean, if he'd been caught with that, God knows what would have happened to him. And that was picked up by a few newspapers a few years ago, which is probably how we sort of came to make contact with him.
And I remember when he came in here to do some press with us, didn't he? There was quite a lot of press interest then.
There was, yeah.
Which I think wasn't long before he passed away, was
no,
it?
No, not long. A year or so, something like that, yeah.
But we got to spend a day with him and his family,
yes.
Didn't we, here?
Yes, which lovely. Yeah. And he was a charming man, very nice. In fact, the volunteer who went to interview Rudy, a chap called Mike Chapman, he became quite friendly with the family. And when Rudy sadly died recently, Mike was actually asked to speak at his funeral, which he gladly did. One of these sort of things you see where, you know, Bletchley Park and its volunteers almost, you know, gives you that little bit extra. You know, it was not just did we interview him.
All of the volunteers probably can tell similar stories. I have as well. You know, I've become friends with veterans who've now sadly passed on, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I still get Christmas cards from some of them, you know. And it's lovely that you know, we made such a connection with them for what, you know, you and your team and me a couple of times for you have done. You know, they're so happy that their mother, their grandmother, got to tell her story,
yes,
aren't they?
It is great because the veterans themselves and their family do often keep in touch with, as you say, with cards and maybe just occasionally just ring up for a chat, which is great. And, you know, if the ones who are able to come to the reunion, it's so nice to see them again. It's like, you know, it is like meeting old friends, you know.
Yeah.
Great, yeah.
It's lovely.
Yeah.
It's Saturday the 30th of November 2019, and this is Mike Chapman, an oral history volunteer for the Bletchley Park Trust, and I'm in Banbury to meet and interview a veteran. If you could introduce yourself, please.
I'm Woodrow Schubel.
And which service were you in World War II?
I was in the Luftwaffe Air.
Right. The Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. We also have, just in case you want to cut in, we also have Rudy's granddaughter. So if you could introduce yourself as well.
My name's Kelly Israel, and I'm Rudy's eldest granddaughter.
And the person who organised this interview, so yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. So if we could start at the beginning, because we're very interested in your life story, not just what you did in World War II. So Could you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born the 13th of June, 1921, in Gottesgab,
right,
which was part of Austria. And, of course, we lost it. It was taken over later on from Germany.
Yeah, the Nazis took over Austria. I think it was called Anschluss, wasn't it, when the Nazis took over your country?
It was more the big towns who suffered.
Right.
The countryside, they always forget about the countryside.
Right, yes.
So we was lucky in one way, but it was taken over. We knew that.
So you'd have still been at school when you were taken over, I guess.
Yeah.
Which year did you leave school? How old were you?
I was 16.
16, so that would have been about 1937.
Then, yeah.
And did you go straight into the Luftwaffe, or did you get another job?
No, I joined the Luftwaffe in 1938.
So did you have another job before joining the Luftwaffe then? What did you do?
I was helping in the motor industry. In the motor industry, I was always interested in motors. So I used the time to fill up with working in the motors industry, repairing engines and so forth, reconditioning. It was quite interesting.
Yes. So were you good with your hands, or was it more academic, engineering, maths and that sort of
thing? Both hands and things done. What I done, the technical side.
Yeah.
and use my hands.
And you said you were using up time, so did you know that you were going to have to join one of the armed forces?
Yes, I knew. Well, right. You knew that when your age comes, that they will call you up.
So you had no choice, that was it?
No, you just get called up and you had to go.
And so what age were you called up then? Was that 18 or was that...
18.
18.
Yeah, 18.
Did you have a choice which service you went into?
Yes. If you volunteer, you had a choice. If you don't, you could just get called up and mostly you go in the infantry. That's why I didn't like to go.
So you decided to volunteer?
I volunteered for the Luftwaffe.
And what sort of training did you get when you joined the Luftwaffe?
Technical training, school training, technical morsing, what was mostly used in the Luftwaffe at that time, and that was interesting.
So they decided that you were going to be a radio operator then, did they?
Yes.
Right. And where did this training take place?
This took place in Nuremberg. I was called into Nuremberg and began a course on morsing insofar.
So that's radio operating, radio sets.
Yeah.
So this then would have been about 1939. So was this just before the war broke out?
38. Yeah. It was a school and there was all set up like in a school class.
Yes.
You know, we had all the morsing about in one line. They explained to us what it is and so far. And of course, we had to learn the Morse alphabet.
So you learned Morse code. Did they teach you anything else about radio operation as well at the same time?
The
procedures, protocols, that kind of thing for the Luftwaffe?
Yeah, well, it was a program. We had to go through it.
Yes.
Right. Everybody had to go through it. And you was tested on speed and knowledge. And then you came in certain classes where certain classes was set up, you know, because some of them they were slow. So they was in different classes, and as you the good ones was picked out.
Right.
And the fast ones.
And were you one of those?
I was okay.
Right. Can you remember what speed you were?
I could do up to 18 letters a minute.
So that's transmitting, that's sending?
Yeah, sending.
What about receiving? Was it a different speed?
Yes. Oh, quite. Made it different.
Yeah.
In hearing, and the speed was important in there.
Mm.
I was quite, not perfect.
Yeah.
But I was enough. Good.
Were you faster receiving than you were sending, or were you slower receiving?
It balanced itself out.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's about equal.
The way you could pick up, you could morse it again. Mm. Could put the speed in, you know.
Yes.
You need it.
Yes. Did they train you on anything else? Teleprinters or anything of that sort? Or were you just on wireless,
yeah,
on radio?
They trained me on Fugate 10, it was a special morsing equipment, the Fugate,
really?
10, and the Fugate 8,
right?
I remember.
So how was that special?
That Fugate 10 was used in fighter aircrafts.
Right.
And the Fugate 8 and 3 was used in military aircrafts.
So how was that special? Was it the type of key that you were using?
The keys were all the same, morsing.
Right, so it was just, it was a vertical key.
It was
wasn't
only the radio itself,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Because in big aircraft, in bombers, was Fugate 10, and in fighter aircraft, there was much, much smaller equipment.
So you've mentioned as well that you used the Enigma machine. Were you trained for that when in Nuremberg, or did that come later?
No, they came later.
Right.
They came later when the Enigma machine came in.
Right.
You know, and I was interested.
Yep. Sounds interesting, yes.
You have to set your Enigma machine up. You know, you've got them three rollers, and you get twice, they change twice a day. Dinner, by 12 o'clock, they changed the numbers and the night times. It changed again.
Okay, interesting. So you've been trained at Nuremberg. Where were you first posted?
I was first posted into Budějovice, in Czechoslovakia.
Right. And that was as a radio operator and an Enigma operator, was it?
Yeah.
Right. And how long were you there for?
We went in 38 and then a few months, and then the war started with France.
Right.
And shortly after, we moved to a dump near Paris.
And were you based at an airfield? You were ground?
I was ground, yeah.
Ground. You were, yeah. You never flew?
No. I'd done flying earlier on training.
They said you were too short, didn't they?
For the fighter aircraft.
Needed to grow a bit.
Yeah, we couldn't. They only picked all the six-footer out.
Yes.
6 foot, I went straight through. But we was always pushed to the side. But a pillow cushion, a rubber cushion in the seat.
Mm.
It lifted you up, so he has longer legs to operate.
A booster seat.
So, what was life like in the Luftwaffe base near Paris?
That's all right.
Where you lived, did you speak to any of the local people?
Yeah, that's right. All right. I had good contacts. Right. With, you know, with people.
Yes. What was the food like?
The food was all right.
Right.
We had enough.
And when did you move to Guernsey then?
41, 42.
Right. So you moved to Guernsey. Whereabouts in Guernsey were you based? Were you at the airfield or were you somewhere else?
We had our own radio station in a private property, the big garden.
Was that the manor house?
Yeah.
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 And it's quite close to the airport, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Isn't that far from
it?
Yeah,
you went back to see it, didn't you?
With the bunker shed right down there. Where I had a room.
Did you live there as well as work there?
No, I only lived a little bit further. First we were staying in the Chalet Hotel.
And what was life like for you in Guernsey?
Good. I went into town, went through the village, and a lady was working in the garden. So I asked her if she does washing. I knew there was a lot of kids there, so my name was short. And she said yes. So I took my bundle of washing, dropped it in there, and I paid her for it. Mrs. Hallett, it was Mrs. Hallett then. She had a lot of children there, and was a bit of help there.
I could
organize more food for the children, which you couldn't get. I didn't smoke and had a lot of cigarettes. And with cigarettes, you could pay anything.
Yes.
Yeah, money was nothing, but cigarettes.
So you gave them cigarettes. Did you give them food as well?
Well, in the shops, yeah.
Right.
They always had some stuff under the day underneath. But if you could put on the table what they want, you know, they had everything.
Right. You could have been in trouble for that, couldn't you?
Yeah. There was even guns. There was death sentence on it for giving civilian army property,
There
was death sentence on it.
Yes. I read up about this because there was a German army doctor who disappeared.
Yeah.
He was smuggling medicines out and he just...
Yeah.
What happened to him, I don't think they're really sure of.
He got shot.
He got shot, didn't he?
He was dumped somewhere. Nobody knows.
You stayed in touch with Mrs. Hallett's family, her daughter, didn't you?
Oh,
Still in touch now.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful story.
That's who we went back to see, didn't we?
Yeah.
Very emotional.
Mrs. Hallett, she treated me like her own son. And there was a lovely, lovely feeling somebody, enemy, likes you.
Yeah.
That was the thing, you know. And I organized a lot of stuff there, what they couldn't get.
And you were there right to the end of the war?
Yeah.
What happened then?
The army came, occupied the islands then, and we were taken prisoner of war. I came over here as prisoner of war then.
Where did they take you?
or up to Scotland.
Did they?
Right. Up to Scotland, we went up to Scotland. They sorted out with Nazi. Mm. I was not the Nazi. That was a lot of bullshit.
Tell Mike where you went in Scotland, the estate that you went on and why you went there.
We went up to Glasgow. There was two camps. There was a camp for Luftwaffe and a camp for Marine. And with the Marine, there was the army in as well.
Yes.
But they gave the Luftwaffe special, separate.
How did you end up at Sandringham, where you did your forestry after the war?
Prisoner of war,
and you met...
Yeah, morning we went out walking, and every morning there was transport standing there from us. And one morning we went out, was standing in a line, and the lieutenant, English lieutenant, but he was German. I recognized it on his dialect. Yeah, he was a German.
Yes.
Spoke to us in German and said, any lad who does know about forestry, where I spent all my life in the forest. My uncle was forest master. He teach me everything. Different trees, different sickness of the, you know, trees catching. And yeah, I learned that though, you know. Big trees would have to be cut out. When they check him, that was proper done, you know. Yes. So they sent me up, right up North Norfolk, in the Queen's estate.
Yes.
And I do the postmaster, or the postkeeper, he was in hospital, and he left messages to get somebody who can sort the trees out. Several trees have to be cut out.
Right.
And they gave me a policeman. That was a rabbit. I could have, if I wanted to escape, I could have escaped just like it. And we had dinner. And our dinner was only one sausage and a part of bread. And we were sitting on the edge and then there. And then suddenly, the Bedford things came and put a table out, white things over, and then the police bloke said to me, oh, I'll bet there comes somebody from the higher up, you know.
Yeah.
And there was Queen Mary.
Really?
Queen Mary, and she speaks lovely German.
Yes.
And we were sitting in the edge of the fort. We could just look over a certain distance. And after about 20 minutes, she must have recognized us over there. And she sent one of them to have who we are. You know, it's a policeman and me, he came over, he said, prisoner of war. I said, yeah. And the police bloke, he knew he had a new uniform. And called me over. He asked me how are we treated. And then she said, do you get enough food? I said, no. And then, anyway, she said, if I want anything, you know, just help yourself. So I took two plates and put some stuff on. Thank you very much.
So when did they release you as a POW then?
They released me in 1948.
Right. And what happened to you then?
By then I already was married then.
How did you get from Norfolk to Essex then?
We were finished up Norfolk, came down to Essex, and prisoner of war camp there. It was an son with a big contractor firm, needed workers, and he asked if they could have some prisoner of war. And we was making new roads, there was 7 houses, and then the house was finished, and the road had to be extended further down because there was for 500 new houses, their estate being built. And we had to do the road, like new road there, and operated a big mixer. And the house where I had a mixer standing there, that was where the showers lived. Just like that.
That's your wife.
That's
Right. And at some point then you would have had the choice of going back to Germany or staying in Britain.
Yeah.
And you chose to stay in Britain.
to stay here, yeah.
Right. And you and Joyce got married?
And then I told my mother, she said, if you have a good life there, enough food, stay where you are.
Yes.
Yeah. It was very bad in Germany. Yeah. And so I did what she told me. There was quite a few who didn't go back.
Yes.
Over England, you know. Yeah. I think it was 21,000 didn't go back.
If you'd have gone back, would you have been in Austria or Germany?
I would have been in Germany.
In Germany?
Yeah.
Right. And would it have been West Germany or East Germany?
East Germany.
East, so you'd have been under Soviet
control. That's why my mother said, if you have a good living, stay where you are.
Yes. And you ended up here in Banbury?
Yeah.
Well.
Quite a story.
It is. And you're 98. Is my maths correct?
Yes.
So another year and a half and you'll get your telegram from the Queen.
Yeah.
In Morse code via the Enigma machine would be good.
Before I turn the recorder off, is there anything else? Any questions you thought we might ask?
Yeah, you ask.
No. I'm offering to you, Rudy, if there's anything that you, any stories that you would like to tell, anything that you...
Is there anything we've forgotten, Grandad, that you think Mike should know about? Anything about the Enigma machines or the war or...
An interesting wartime, yeah. I mean, I never was asked to take a rifle and shoot somebody I even don't know.
No.
I was lucky.
Yes.
Because if they would have done, and I refused it...
Yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Straight on the wall, bang, finish. They don't bother with you, you know. They don't bother. So,
did anyone ever...
I was lucky.
It's been very interesting to hear your story. And I want to say thank you very much.
It will add
to the Bletchley Park collection.
Yeah.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.